It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a group that's trying to use an old Wisconsin law to raise the minimum wage here in the state.
First, this weekend, veterans and their spouses from around the state and region will head to Madison for a 3-day crash course in entrepreneurship.
They'll be attending Patriot Boot Camp, a nonprofit program associated with the startup accelerator Techstars, which helps entrepreneurs grow their ideas into viable businesses.
Patriot Boot Camp aims to do that for veterans. Organizers say vets have experience that makes them particularly good at starting businesses and are more likely to hire other veterans.
The program started in New York City. It's now spreading around the country. Madison is the only location so far in the Midwest. Taylor McLemore, founder of Patriot Boot Camp, joins us now. Taylor, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, what does Techstars do?
So Techstars is a mentor-led accelerator in the tech space. And specifically what we run is Techstars Patriot Bootcamp, which is actually a community program and a nonprofit effort by Techstars to reach out to the veteran and military spouse community because we have the belief that they are incredible entrepreneurs and make sure that they have access to resources so that when they do try to become entrepreneurs, they can be as successful as quickly as possible. And the way we do that is through a very simple 3-day program. It's been offered annually for the past 3 years. We're actually doing it twice this year. And the point is that our men and women who have served both as veterans and then also their families and their spouses have given a lot. And we want to help them continue to be people that give a lot to our country as they build the companies that will continue the economic growth as this country moves forward.
And what makes veterans in particular good potential entrepreneurs?
Veterans have a great skill set for this. They are dynamic problem solvers, which I think is one of the most important things for being an entrepreneur. They are trained to analyze situations, understand how to see the different component parts of delivering a solution in a dynamic environment, and doing that, most importantly, with limited resources. And a lot of what I just described about the veteran experience, whether that's someone who was fighting combat on the ground in one of the military theaters, one of the logistics people supporting them, one of the people in the aircraft above them, or people back at home in the United States that support the military through their functions, those elements of the military experience translate very well to the entrepreneurial one because you're going out trying to solve an issue for customers, deliver a service or a product with resources that probably aren't sufficient to achieve the vision, and you have to find those resources and improvise as you go.
You know, I think of being an entrepreneur in a startup as a very high-stress environment. You're probably reaching out to the one group of people who would look at this and say, you call that stress?
Exactly. Their bar for what is challenging, what is stressful is very different. And that's something that I have seen personally is this group of entrepreneurs is able to really have a lot of balance in their vision and perspective about keeping the goal of building a startup or an entrepreneurial venture going while still saying, you know what, there's larger aspects to life than just this business. And I think it's actually a competitive advantage for them versus some people when you jump in as an entrepreneur and you might not have that background, they get so wrapped up in it. So I agree. They are. They have a unique perspective on it all.
So suppose a veteran signs up for this Patriot Boot Camp. They go to this 3-day thing. What kind of things do they learn? What kind of services do they get offered there?
Sure. So it's a combination of mentorship, education, and focus on community. So those are really our three pillars. And we believe that mentoring is one of the most powerful aspects for creating a successful entrepreneur. It's the simple idea that, you know, until you've experienced it personally and seen it firsthand, it's hard to make the right decisions all the time, and that we can really benefit from working together, whether that's peer mentorship or working with someone who's had a lot more success than you, so that you can find the right path quickly. When people come to Patriot Boot Camp, they get the opportunity to interact with probably 3 to 6 very seasoned mentors that can be successful entrepreneurs, lawyers, finance people, all different spectrums. And then what we do is we also support that with some good education. Now, since it's only a 3-day program, it's hard to really teach a lot in that short time. So we really approach it with let's arm you with some basic knowledge and frameworks for what you should go focus and learn when you leave. More than anything, it's just about getting people pointed in the right direction. Lastly, and probably most importantly, is that community aspect. For veteran entrepreneurs to know that there are other veteran entrepreneurs might sound like a simple idea, but every time we've done this, it's actually very powerful. A lot of people are sitting there when they show up and say, I didn't know there was anyone else that was a veteran entrepreneur. And the truth is that there are a ton of them. And it's hard to be successful as an entrepreneur. There's a lot of ups and downs. And especially being a military entrepreneur, being able to connect with people that have that common background gives you a set of resources and an infrastructure to go through that roller coaster in a much better fashion.
So apart from those contacts, is there any kind of follow-up after this seminar to check in with the veterans of the Patriot Boot Camp?
Definitely. So we have an online community that is active almost on a daily basis of people posting questions, sharing resources. It's things of, I just found this great overview on software as a service companies. So I share that with the group, and then people start asking questions and just have a conversation flowing. Or someone will ask a question along the lines of, hey, I'm hiring my first salesperson for my company. How should I think about what the right person is for that role? And then the conversation just evolves from there. So what we do, since Patriot Boot Camp is really this very concentrated, on-location, three-day event, is then we take a very distributed digital networked approach to building that community, because people come from all corners of the United States. And in fact, we've had people, service members, travel from abroad back to the United States for our event. So it's really important for us to connect all those people as they go forward. The way that I really think about Patriot Boot Camp is that if you're going to build an entrepreneurial venture, it's a long process. And it's kind of like building a fire. And we want to be that spark that helps you ignite the fire. And there's lots of other great programs and assistance out there for veteran entrepreneurs that sustain after that initial three-day spark. So we focus on partnering with other organizations as well to support entrepreneurs for the first few years of their trajectory.
There's been a lot of focus on employment and unemployment for veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. Are businesses run by veterans more likely to hire other veterans?
Yes. And there's a variety of studies out there that can corroborate this. But I've also seen it anecdotally firsthand that veterans do hire veterans. I think that there is a cultural fit that occurs there. And I think it's one of the competitive advantages. It's not We in no way believe that or hope that our companies that go through our program become all veterans, but a lot of them become, as they start growing, significantly veteran-led and have veteran components to them. And it just creates a very unique culture that is focused on execution in a way that most startups don't have, going back to our previous point, that background in having a mission and making sure that you complete the mission every day.
I know the itinerary, there's been a lot of these events focused on the coasts and the big cities. And now Madison, I understand, is the only one planned for the Midwest. Why did the Patriot Boot Camp choose to come to Wisconsin, to Madison in particular?
For sure. So as you stated, we focused on the coast up to this point. And our goal is to say, how can we take this model and make it accessible to more communities? Because we've had responses and interest from people all over the United States, both in large and small communities. And Madison was great because we have two alumni, Chris Johnson and Michael Ertmer, who stepped up, and they're alumni of our past Patriot Boot Camp program. So they get what we're trying to deliver with this vision. And they said, we want to bring this to Wisconsin. And we said, we've been trying to think about this idea of how to enable communities to lead this so there can be more Patriot Boot Camps around the country, and we're acting as advisors and supporters, and they're really the ones executing on the ground in Madison. So it's important to me that we, A, make it accessible, and B, work with people directly in the community so that it is by the community and for the community. And we're excited about Wisconsin.
Do you have examples of veterans? Well, you just mentioned a couple of alumni here, veterans who are starting businesses in Wisconsin.
Well, those two gentlemen are both veterans that went through our Patriot Boot Camp program. Chris is a professor at the University of Wisconsin and also is an entrepreneur in a flight simulator company that he's building up. So So he's a great example. Michael is involved on multiple fronts, but actively, you know, on he is an employee of the company Eat Street, which I'm not sure if you are familiar with them, but a very impressive, fast-growing company in Madison that obviously supports veteran entrepreneurs and veteran employees. And so there's a lot of great stuff that we're proud to, you know, be connected to and see veterans being successful in this company.
If a veteran's out there thinking about participating, is this only, you know, when I think of startups and entrepreneurs, I think high tech. Is this mainly geared toward high tech stuff, or can any potential entrepreneurial veteran check it out?
So we focus on the technology side, and we try not to differentiate between kind of whatever that space is between high tech versus whatever else. It really is, for us, any veteran that is interested in building a business where technology will really enable it to grow and scale, that's what we want to help with. Now, if there are veterans that are interested in other forms of entrepreneurship, because entrepreneurship is obviously a lot broader and a lot deeper than just tech startups, there are wonderful programs out there. You know, I'd highly recommend looking at programs from the Institute for Veteran and Military Families out of Syracuse University. Their programs are around the country. There's the Bunker, which is a great new incubator housed at 1871 in Chicago. And the point being, entrepreneurship is broad. We focus on the tech side just because that's where we have the resources. We have those mentors that are so critical to our experience from the tech world. So we just try to stay true to what we know well.
Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Taylor McLemore, founder of Techstars Patriot Bootcamp. For more info about the program, you can head to the Central Time Facebook page. You can sign up through this evening for this weekend's free event. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, it might be time to think about skipping the stretching before we exercise. We'll hear about some new research about the tried and true exercise ritual.
First, a look at the minimum wage here in Wisconsin.
The group Wisconsin Jobs Now is trying to use a 101-year-old state law to force Wisconsin to boost its minimum wage. The group is organizing low-wage workers who are presenting testimonials about how they can't live on what they're paid. Here's a clip the group sent us sharing the story of Brittany Ferguson.
I make $9 an hour at the hotel housekeeper. My income is not enough to support myself or my family. As an example, I had a few weeks ago while grocery shopping. When I got to the checkout, I realized my total was more than I had. Even my food stamp card couldn't cover it. In front of my kids and a store full of people, I made the decision to choose either hot dogs or bread for my kids to eat. This situation was humiliating, and my daughter didn't understand. She asked me, why if I worked? Why don't I have enough money to buy hot dogs and bread?
Here to discuss this campaign is Jen Epps Addison. She's the executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. Jen, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for covering this incredibly important issue.
Well, we just heard that testimonial from Brittany Ferguson, a low-wage worker. Why are you collecting these stories and sharing them?
Well, I think, you know, what's important to understand is that it's workers out there collecting these stories. They're talking to their coworkers. They're leading campaigns. They're asking the folks that they work with to, you know, come out of the shadows and come out to the public about what it's like to be an underpaid worker, what it's like to get up every day, work as hard as you possibly can, contribute billions of dollars in profit to the economy and still not be able to feed your family at night. And I'm so proud of Brittany. I'm getting emotional now just thinking about her testimony. I have chills because she breaks her back as a maid in a hotel, ensuring that families have the opportunity to take their kids on vacation and enjoy those peaceful times in life, and yet she has none of those, even though she works incredibly hard.
Now, what's this law you're using to convince the state government to raise the minimum wage?
Well, it's a good Wisconsin old-time progressive values law, and it was established over 101 years ago. And essentially what it does is it says that the state of Wisconsin shall not allow any worker to make less than a living wage. And so it actually allows workers, if the situation is that the state legislature doesn't act or the governor will not act, it allows workers to file a complaint, which triggers a process that the state must actually evaluate whether or not the wage that's being paid to the workers of Wisconsin is, in fact, a living wage. It's a wonderful, good old-fashioned Wisconsin law that ensures that equal opportunity and economic security are available to the greatest number of Wisconsinites.
But this law, as I understand it, doesn't really define what the concept of a living wage is, what it means. Does that make it difficult to make this case now?
Actually, no, I don't think it does, because, one, there's, you know, a mountain of research about what it takes, what the actual costs are for raising families. We have incredible research that's been done over a number of years. Two, you know, what this law is set up to trigger is allowing people who are actually living on these wages to file a complaint, to have a legal avenue and a available remedy for poverty wages. And this is exactly what we need to do in an economy where the fastest growing jobs are in low wage service sector industries. We've never seen profits higher for these corporations. The gap between the rich and the poor is getting wider and wider, and Wisconsin has the distinction of having, you know, a major metropolitan area that is the worst in the country in both income and racial segregation and income inequality. So, you know, the state of Wisconsin is heading in the wrong way. We're not addressing the fact that the fastest growing jobs are these poverty wage jobs, and we have people who are literally helping to make billions of dollars in profits who are relying on public assistance. We are subsidizing the profits of fast food companies, of Walmart, of these CEOs who have these extravagant and exorbitant lifestyles. And we can't afford to do it anymore as a state. We have to take back control and talk about what's in the public interest. That's what this law was set up to do. It was set up to allow the workers of the state an avenue to take back control and to do what is in the public interest.
So stories like the one we heard there from Brittany Ferguson, they are the challenge under this law, presenting these stories to the state and saying, hey, review this. This is evidence.
Absolutely. I mean, what the governor has to do is he has to sit down and say, is there a way for Brittany Ferguson, a hardworking Wisconsinite, a hardworking Wisconsin family, is there a way for her to survive on the $9 an hour she makes as a hotel maid, helping to make profits for the corporations of the state? Is it enough for her to have a decent lifestyle? Can she afford the basics for her family, keeping her lights on, keeping a roof over her head, being able to live independently and, you know, afford food without the need of government assistance? And if not, then the state needs to act and determine what a living wage is. What is the minimum amount that workers need to be paid to live a decent lifestyle? The law is plain English. It is clear. And it says the state of Wisconsin shall do this. It is the highest level of legal scrutiny there is, shall. It's a determination. It's a direction.
Do you have a number in mind that would you think an hourly wage that would reflect a minimum wage, a living wage?
Well, look, you know, if, minimum wage, if it would have kept up with inflation, if it would have just risen at the same level as inflation, it'd be right around $11 an hour. And, you know, if it kept up with worker productivity, which is really the measure of a fair economy, it would be right around 20. So I think, you know, it's incumbent upon the governor. The governor is the one who has to act to actually do an impartial determination about what actually constitutes a living wage. And I think for that, he's going to need to take testimony from the hundreds of thousands of Wisconsin workers who are living below the federal poverty line. He has to take that seriously. Any governor should. This is not a partisan issue. You know, we should, you know, explain to folks that the majority of Republicans, not just Democrats, the majority of Republicans agree that the state should raise its minimum wage. Poll after poll has shown that. It is an incredibly bipartisan issue. It's probably the most important issue we can address in this state, and the governor is refusing to act. He's refusing to acknowledge that wages are declining in Wisconsin. They have been year after year, and we have to do something. We have to do something about the fact that our manufacturing jobs have been replaced by low-wage service sector jobs. And even though there are no shortage of profits, these are incredibly profitable billion-dollar corporations, wages are declining, even though we're more educated as a workforce than we've ever been before. 30% of these folks have some form of college degree.
We're talking to Jen Epps Addison. She's executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now, about the group's campaign to use a century-old Wisconsin law saying, in effect, the state can't allow employers to pay less than a living wage. They're using this law in an effort to raise the minimum wage here in Wisconsin.
And we'd love to hear from you about this. Do you think that it's a good idea to raise the minimum wage? Why or why not? And how do you think raising the minimum wage would change our state's economy? What do you think the minimum wage should be to constitute, as we're hearing, a living wage? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll continue the conversation and maybe hear your thoughts after the news right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about raising the minimum wage in Wisconsin with Jen Epps Addison, the head of Wisconsin Jobs Now.
And we're taking your calls. Do you think it's a good idea to raise the minimum wage in Wisconsin? Why or why not? What should the minimum wage be? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Before we get to callers, Jen, we hear from business owners often, if you increase the minimum wage, great. I'm not going to be able to hire as many people. There aren't going to be as many jobs out there.
I mean, I think we know that's been proven to be a falsity. When we look at the data, when you look at the research, the states with the fastest growing economies are the states that have raised their minimum wage in the last year. Empirically, you know, it makes sense. 70% of our economy is consumer-driven. So if people don't have enough money in their pockets to afford a luxury every now and then, but, you know, not even the basic necessities, we're talking about a worker who, you know, has to choose between hot dogs and bread, even though she's on public assistance. I mean, this is ridiculous. She's working. That is not, you know, we keep hearing her, I quote from her just, it's so powerful to me. She said, you know, today that we keep hearing from Governor Walker that it's working. And, you know, that he's out here working for Wisconsin families, and I'm a Wisconsin working family, and it's not working for me, and it's not working for, you know, hundreds of thousands of families across our state. We should all be outraged about that. This isn't a Democrat or Republican issue. You look at even Michigan, you know, the Republican governor in Michigan agreed to raise the state's minimum wage. We have Republican governors across the country who have agreed to expand Medicare. Let's not forget that there are nearly 20 referendums across the state of Wisconsin asking should the state of Wisconsin accept the federal Medicaid expansion money. And the majority of the people in this state believe that we should, right? These are core basic issues to the direction our state is heading in. And right now, you know, we have elected officials who are putting partisan politics over the best interests of our state. And it's the best interest of all working families, not Democrat families, not Republican families, Wisconsin's hard-working families across the state.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Steve on the line in Eau Claire. Steve, hi.
Hi. I want to say, yes, I am in favor of increasing the minimum wage. I also want to say that I'd like to give a brief historical perspective and then ask how I can help. I'm semi-retired now. I entered the workforce in the mid-60s, and in the mid-60s we had a thriving middle class, a booming economy. CEOs were making 40 times what the minimum wage worker was making, and I was entering the workforce as a minimum wage worker at $1.25 an hour. That was not a good job, but it was something that a kid living with his parents could benefit from, and I did. Flash forward to now, when in the 60s a gallon of gas was 30 cents a gallon, a loaf of bread was in the mid-20s, a pair of jeans was $5 to $7. Everything today is 10 times more expensive as it was then. So $1.25 an hour should be closer to $12, $13 an hour just to match minimum wage at that time. But now we've got CEOs working at 400 times what the minimum wage is earning. are of their workers is earning. We've got complications with wealth flowing from the middle class to the upper 1% and the rest of the country suffering the politics of that. I would like to support your effort, especially since you've got this great news, an old Wisconsin law, which both, it's got to be nonpartisan. Both parties have to agree that an old law based on fairness is something both parties can rally behind.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. His last point there, you wanted to support, I think, was asking how people can support that effort, Jen.
Well, thank you, Steve, and absolutely to everything you said. Folks should just go to our website, raisewisconsin.org. You can find out all of the information on the campaign, how you can get involved, how you can help other workers file complaints. We know that there are hundreds of thousands of workers who, you know, would benefit from increasing the state's minimum wage, who, you know, are struggling to support their families. Those folks need to come forward and come out of the shadows. You know, Brittany and also Brandy from Wausau, Wisconsin, testified today, and it was terrifying, I think, for both of them. It was emotional for both of them. There's such a shame that, you know, the governor and other people have put in underpaid workers. And these are folks doing really critical jobs to our economy. The fast food industry is one of the most profitable industries in the country. Home health care is one of the most important services we have. We have people going to take care of the sick, the elderly, and the disabled, and they can't even afford to go to the doctor themselves. You know, this is real life for people, and it's you know, completely against everything that Wisconsin is supposed to be. We were the state that invested in public education so that everybody would have the opportunity to, you know, advance themselves. And we had a workforce that is more educated than ever before, and yet they are falling behind on wages. It makes no sense. It's time that we correct this, and this law was put into place over 101 years ago to give workers the opportunity to have a say when their elected officials are being corrupted by the money in politics, and that's exactly what's happening today.
Steve, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Karen with us in Green Bay. Karen, hi.
Hi. I am a supporter of increasing the minimum wage. My concern is that corporations are just going to either increase prices or pass more insurance costs, which is kind of the trend for today, off to the worker. So in eventuality, they wouldn't actually receive more spendable income.
Karen, thanks. So this will cost us more, and workers will end up having to pay in another way, Jen.
Well, I think there's an incredible social pressure. For instance, there was a company in Minnesota who, after Minnesota agreed to pass the law to raise the state's minimum wage, actually put on one of their receipts a minimum wage fee, which I think it was something like 35 cents. It was a small fee, but a minimum wage fee. And that, you know, that got spread over social media. The customer actually took a picture of it, put it out on Twitter, put it out on Facebook. It spread over social media, and within days, the social pressure forced the company to stop the practice. I think people are tired of the, you know, doomsday predictions, because the reality is that it just doesn't bear it. You have the market is going to bear what it can bear, and right now, you know, wages are going down, but the prices of goods are going up, and income inequality is as high as it's ever been, and we're seeing that destructive force happening in our economy. We need to right the ship. We need to expand our middle class. If we look at, you know, the difference in CEO pay from when we had the greatest and most expansive middle class in the history of the world, the strongest middle class in the history of the world, and what we're seeing today, you know, it makes no sense. This is America's a richer nation than we've ever been. So why are worker wages declining? It makes no sense. It's time that we fix it. And we have a law that is 101 years old that gives us the opportunity to fix it, that gives Governor Walker the opportunity to show leadership and do what's in the best interest of the working people of this state.
Karen, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Jim with us in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Hi. I guess my question is, I hear that lady testify about choosing between hot dogs and bread, and it really is gut-wrenching to hear her have to make that decision. But what's frustrating to me, I think, is I talk to a lot of people who drive truck, work in manufacturing, work in all kinds of different areas with skilled trades, and they can't find people to fill the jobs. And they're really good-paying jobs. They're much better paying than than being a maid or working in fast food. And I think the better way to expand the middle class would be to get more people to be willing to apply for these jobs and take them. They're from not being able to find people to sew for some of these things to heavy manufacturing, light manufacturing, drivers for long haul. They can't find people to fill their jobs, and a lot of those are really good paying jobs that would help people a lot more than the minimum wage.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Jenny's saying, don't forget the minimum wage. You can't get people to take better paying jobs as it is.
Well, I think, look, there's research about the idea of the skills gap, and really, what most of the research has found is there's more of a pay gap than there is a skills gap. But I think one thing to be careful about, look, 2/3 of minimum wage workers are women. We have to remember that the industries where folks are most likely to earn low wages, poverty wages, and to be underpaid are the service sectors that women are traditionally doing, whether that's cooking and preparing and serving food, whether it's taking care of the sick or the elderly or taking care of children, whether it's, going into education. These are nursing. These are incredibly important jobs, but they're underpaid and they're undervalued, and yet they make huge profits. And so I think we need to be careful about saying what types of jobs are valuable and not valuable. The reality is that if these are the fastest growing jobs in our economy, then we need to be able to fill those jobs. We need to be able to make sure that the people who are doing those jobs are able to support their families and are able to live independently, and that we keep corporations in check.
Jen, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Jen Epps Addison. She's the executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. She was with us to discuss the group's campaign to raise the minimum wage in Wisconsin. Recent news, including nude celebrity photo leaks and threats and harassment online, have helped paint a picture of the internet as an unfriendly place for women. Coming up after 5, we'll hear about efforts to turn that online culture around. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Amid the hustle of the state's busiest emergency room, nurses have to keep a cool head. Rebecca Ramazzini takes us inside a hospital on Milwaukee's northwest side.
I believe that this is what makes me a good nurse. I walk through these doors every single day with a healthy fear. If you're not afraid a little bit of what could happen that day, you become complacent. My name's Rebecca Ramazzini. I'm a registered nurse at Wheaton Franciscan St. Joseph in Milwaukee in their emergency department. I've been a nurse for 11 years. If you want to work in a fast-paced environment, you're going to work in the emergency department. We hit high intense moments all the time. We have multiple critical patients coming in at the same time, but when you're in that room with that one patient, that's the one patient that matters at that point in time.
Okay, let me go grab you a blanket.
I love learning about people, and I like the science of nursing. I love looking at labs and looking at their past medical history and trending their vital signs, the critical thinking aspect of nursing. I like titrating drips. I like training new nurses. I like teaching them how to be a good nurse. In the emergency department, I think of what is the worst possible scenario that could happen, and I work backwards from there. And that is what keeps my fear down from losing it or being in a situation where I feel overwhelmed. Because then if the worst thing that could happen right now is somebody lose their pulse, yeah, that's scary, right? But I'm trained to do CPR. So I can help that, and then it's not so scary. I love my drive home. I have about a 25-minute drive home, and I don't play the radio. I drive home just in silence. I kind of review my day. I think about what I did, what I didn't do, what I could have done better. But fortunately, this job, it's not something that you have to take home. You review in your head, and then you let it go. And I think that that's the way that I stay sane, because you see things that most people don't see. You see patients at their worst. You see families broken. But then there's those days that completely rejuvenate you. I can say, if I work 4 shifts a week, one of those shifts, I have definitely saved somebody's life. I would assume that some people's jobs are, you know, just their jobs. Sometimes you ask people, give a couple words to describe yourself, and other than saying mom, I would say nurse. It's hard to explain, but it makes up so much of my life.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council and its Working Lives Project, where you can hear more from Wisconsin's working people. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Now some new research on a long-time question: does stretching before exercise help reduce injury? It's been a standard part of exercise routines for a long time, but it turns out it may be time to rethink the common wisdom about the value of stretching.
Ian McMahon joins us now. He's a journalist and sports medicine professional. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
So as the common wisdom goes, stretching before exercise helps prevent injury. And we're talking here about the kind many of us had to do in gym class, where you sit on the floor, you grab your toe, you pull it behind, you hold it for 20 seconds or something. It feels mildly uncomfortable. Why have we thought along those lines that this is good for us for so long?
Well, you know, as you said, many of us were taught in PE and gym class and by our coaches that we had to stretch before exercise and that it was critical for injury prevention and performance. But in the past several years, I think scientists have realized that it may not be so beneficial. Several studies show that there's not really any beneficial effect to stretching before exercise. No reduction in injuries, and particularly no reduction in overuse injuries.
Well, it seemed like a good idea. I guess that you stretch, you lengthen your muscles, and therefore, you know, they're not tight. You heard that in gym class, and your muscles won't be tight, and you won't get injured. Why doesn't that play out in practice?
Well, you know, then it is true, you know, stretching does improve, you know, the range of motion around a joint, you know, at least temporarily right after you stretch. But, you know, the studies show that the muscles are actually inhibited for a time after stretching, and that's really what has the effect on performance. There's about a 20% reduction in strength right after static stretching, and anywhere from a 1% to 5% reduction in performance after stretching. So the muscle just isn't really ready to contract forcefully right after it's been stretched.
So it's less strong. That seems surprising to me. Why would stretching a muscle weaken its strength?
Well, you know, the researchers haven't really pinpointed the exact reason. The leading theory is that it's a neurological inhibition of the muscle that lasts for, you know, 20 to 30 minutes after the stretching session.
And then you said it also inhibits sort of endurance capability. I guess if you're going to do something that requires sort of a quick spring motion, a sprint or something like that, then stretching could actively inhibit your performance.
It does. And, you know, stretching, at least static stretching immediately before exercise, reduces vertical jump. It decreases speed. But it also has an effect on endurance capacity, primarily a factor called endurance efficiency. In other words, it's sort of like a gas mileage for your body during exercise. The stretching, because of its effect on the muscles, reduces the sort of gas mileage of the muscle, making you expend more energy to hold a certain pace.
Now, for most of us, we may not notice if it takes us an extra 45 seconds to run a mile, but if you're a competitive runner, that's a big deal if you're clocking on anything onto your time, especially if it's because of something like stretching. What have researchers found about, you know, actual times and impacts?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. The, you know, stretching does have a significant effect, especially for, you know, higher level runners or cyclists or any endurance athlete. And, you know, even if you're not a, you know, elite athlete, I think it begs the question of, should you spend your time stretching before exercise when it's pretty clear that you're not going to receive much benefit from it? I think the thing to do right before exercise is warm up. That has shown to have some beneficial effect.
And in terms of stretching itself not helping us, and you said it inhibits different muscle performance rates, is there any link to stretching with increased risk of injury?
Well, that is a controversial subject, and several studies have shown that stretching inhibits agility and balance. So, you know, it could play a role in, you know, acute injuries, let's say, on a soccer field. If your sense of balance or agility is affected right after stretching and you run down the field and make a rapid cut, if your body can't react, you know, as it normally would to the cut or the acceleration, perhaps you may be more at risk for injury.
We hear a lot about the popularity of yoga these days, and it seems like the goal there is to be as flexible as you possibly can. Is that, as far as we know, a good thing? I mean, that's one kind of stretching, but if you're doing that, what do we know about the effects?
Well, I think, you know, yoga has a lot of benefits, you know, definitely psychological benefits and its activity, and in that respect, it's good. But, you know, certainly yoga in its traditional form of, you know, more static holds, I think falls into the same category of static stretching. And general flexibility, you know, there's been research that shows that being really, really flexible and being really not flexible are both risk factors for injury.
But as we get older, we lose range of motion naturally. Is it healthy in that case to engage in this kind of static stretching?
In that case, I think it is.
When would you want to start kicking that into gear?
I think, you know, sixth decade, you know, 50s and 60s, I think that would probably be a time to incorporate more static stretching.
So you said there are, you know, these different kinds of stretching. What about the dynamic kind? If we're not going to be doing the static stretching that kind of feels wonky to begin with, is there a kind of exercise that we should be doing before we really sink into our workout?
Dynamic stretching is a form of stretching where it's basically there's no static hold, there's no prolonged, you know, as you said, touch your toes kind of stretching. It's more flowing, more dynamic, and that does not have the same detrimental effect on performance or injury that the static form does. You know, I think you could call dynamic stretching a form of warm up because that's sort of what it is. You're increasing blood flow to muscles and you're moving. So I think dynamic stretching or warming up are both very appropriate before exercise.
So what would that be? Some light jogging, some jumping jacks, that kind of thing?
Exactly. You know, a general warm-up and then perhaps a more sports-specific warm-up. You know, for instance, if you're a swimmer, you know, swinging your arms in a circle, you know, a runner, a light jog, things like that.
Great. Well, Ian, thanks for bringing us up to speed on this.
It's been my pleasure.
Ian McMahon is a journalist and a sports medicine professional.